And it's 1 o'clock. So, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to yet another edition of ITE1 Class 1, Chapter 12 Supplementary Windows 7. Welcome to the wonderful world of Windows 7, folks, Microsoft's newest operating system. It's been around for less than 2 years, but it's already making inroads into the mighty XP, evidenced even in this class where the majority of you have already upgraded. It's perhaps for this reason that CompTIA decided to include Windows 7 content in its A-plus exams for this year, and also why Cisco has followed suit for this course. You've already done some labs with it, and you've seen it mentioned in chapter notes and in past lectures. But there's also an exam to sit, so we decided it was time we focused exclusively on Windows 7, and this is what today's lecture will be about. I'll introduce its minimum hardware and system requirements, the different features and the four versions, and quickly touch on methods of installation and the user account control. Then Elise will show you some of the new onboard features and tools, such as display settings, backup, and the device stage. After we're done, I hope you'll all be in a good position to pass the Windows 7 module exam, which will be available for you to sit from this week. I'd also suggest that before you sit, you review chapters 5 and 12 for good measure. Now, as you're already aware, there are four versions of Windows 7 available to the home user. They are Starter, Home Premium, Professional, and Ultimate. You need to know which versions can do what, and this will help you choose the right version for you or for a customer. So let's have a look at some of these features. First, let's look at Windows 7 Starter. At minimum, it needs a 1 gigahertz or faster processor for a 32-bit or a 64-bit system. It needs a minimum of 1 gigabyte of RAM, a hard drive with at least 16 gigs of available space for a 32-bit, and a DirectX 9 graphics device with WDDM 1.0 or later driver. Now, most of these features actually apply to all versions of Windows. You will find the only differences are two things. One, that 64-bit systems above Starter tend to want 2 gigs of RAM, and they tend to want at least 20
20.
gigs of hard drive space.
20
So,
gigs of hard drive space,
32,
sorry, yep.
yes, 32-bit needs requires at least 16 gigs of hard drive space minimum, and 64-bit requires at least 20 gigs of hard drive space minimum. Those things are important to remember. Okay, what does Windows Starter offer? Windows 7 Starter. Jump lists, PIN, Snap, and Windows Search. And of course, it's a good choice for consumers with a netbook because the other thing you need to know is that Windows Starter is only available for netbooks. What I'm going to do from now is just explain some of these features as I go, especially some of the stranger sounding ones. Not because you need to know for the exam, but I'm hoping that if I do that, they'll become a bit more real to you and won't be just rote learning that you have to learn about. And maybe I'll whet some of your curiosity enough so that you want to play around with some of these things yourself. Okay, jump lists from the Microsoft website itself. Jump lists are lists of recently opened items, such as files, folders, or websites, organized by the program that you use to open them. You can use a jump list to open items, and you can also pin favorites to a jump list, so you can quickly get to the items that you use every day. So I suppose, really, in some ways, you could call it a bit of an extension of internet favorites. What it does is it makes favorite website, well, not favorite website, but most and often used websites available to you that you use every day. And those lists are dynamic, by the way. So, for instance, if you wanted to do the same in Microsoft Word and you are working on a writing project, that would be available to you every day. Now, what you can do with a jump list is you can also pin things to it so that they always stay in the same place to stop them being updated with new, more recently used things. So you have a little bit of flexibility with jump lists. Now, you can manage them from the program icons in the start menu or from the buttons in the taskbar. And you just click on those and add things to jump lists. It's a fairly straightforward procedure. Okay, that is Windows 7 Starter covered. Have we got any more questions before we move on to Windows 7 Home Premium? Because that's where the fun starts. Okay, Home Premium. Again, we want a minimum 1 gigahertz processor. That's both for 32 and 64-bit. It's 1 gig of RAM for 32-bit and 2 gigs of RAM for 64-bit. And again, the old 16 gig of hard drive for 32-bit and 20 gig for 64. And the same DirectX 9 graphics device. Now, do bear in mind that once you get into the higher versions of Windows, if you want some of the display themes and tools to work, you will need a higher end graphics card than the minimum, a much higher end. You need to remember that these requirements are very minimal requirements indeed, extremely so. They are bare bones. Okay. Now, some of Windows premium features are Shake, which Elise will tell you about when we get to the desktop, customizable themes, improved desktop navigation, and by that I think they mean things like Aero, which Elise will also tell you about, Internet TV, which is fairly self-explanatory, and Home Group, which is a strange sounding thing, which I'll tell you about in a minute. And Home Premium is a good choice for home users who want to share media. Now, before I talk about Home Group, I want to mention offline services. And the reason I mention it here is because it's a feature that is not present on Home Premium. It is not present on Home Premium, even though you will find it on every other version of Windows since Windows 2000. Don't ask me why, it's just it is, but it's something you need to know. Windows Home Pre 7 Home Premium does not support offline services. What that means is you can make network shared files available offline so you can work on them while away from the net. And when you connect back in, the changes you've made are synchronized with the existing files on the network. If you remember that under the typical File menu, there's a Make Available Offline option, that's what I'm referring to. And there are more details about the service in your Chapter 12 chapter notes. It just gives you an idea of how to use the service. But the thing that you need to know for the Windows 7 exam is Home Premium does not support offline services. Okay, what's this strange thing called Home Group? Well, Home Group lets you easily and automatically share printers, multimedia files, and documents over your home network. You can be flexible about what you share, and you can assign permissions at the folder and file level. What are permissions, people?
That's what people are allowed to do with the files, where they're allowed to read them, write them, modify them, that sort of thing.
Exactly, Kate. And by default, Home Group shared files are read-only, although you can change that. So, Home Group files, once you've shared them, are by default read-only. Now, although you can join an existing Home Group with every version of 7, including Windows Starter, only Home Premium and above will automatically create a Home Group upon installation. To get to your Home Group, you just type the words Home Group, and that's one word. Actually, it's only one word, not two. Into the search box under the control panel and select Home Group. And then on the Share with other home computers running Windows 7 page, you can elect to create a home group if one doesn't exist or join an existing one. Then it's a matter of following the bouncing ball. It's a wizard. It's all you're using. Of course, access to your home group is protected by a password, which you give to anyone wishing to add their Windows 7 computer to your home group. To access shared files on a computer other than yours that's connected to your home group, hit the Start button and then the user whose files you want to access. This, of course, depends on their computer being powered on and fully awake. Now, with Windows Home Premium, if your computer belongs to a domain, which we'll discuss in a little bit, you can join a home group, but you can't create one. You can access files and resources on other home group computers, but you can't share your own files and resources with the home group because you actually belong to a domain. For this reason, for this, you'd need to actually go up to Windows 7 Professional, and that's our next system. Has anyone got any questions on what Home Group is and does? Cool. Personally, actually, I don't see that it's any different than manipulating your TCP/IP settings and putting on DHCP, but hey, I think these things are designed for people who don't know perhaps as much about networking as you do. So, onwards and upwards, Windows 7 Professional. And again, we have the same hardware requirements, the minimum 1 gigahertz processor or faster. the 1 gig of RAM for 32 and the 2 gig of RAM for 64, you get the idea. And the hard drive with how much space for 32-bit?
16
and 20 for
Yep.
64.
Exactly. Yep, that's cool. So I won't go over hardware requirements from now on because we all know them. And they are listed very well in your Chapter 5 notes if you need to refer to them again. One feature that Home Premium has is called location aware printing and also Windows XP mode and domain join. You can also back up to home or business network, and it's a good choice for people who use business applications and want to secure data. Right, joining a domain. Let's talk about that because we've been talking about domains and groups. You've already heard about what Home Group does. It lets you share files on a home network. Now, the typical average home network, now Elise's one isn't a typical average home network because it's client server, but most home networks just consist of computers which either plug into or access the modem and router using wireless. This is a peer-to-peer network because there's no central control. Domains are typically found in businesses where parts of the network have been divided into sections or subnets. To join a domain, you need to know the name of the domain as well as have a user account and, of course, a password. If you click on System Properties, which is under where are System Properties, people? You've been there to look at your RAM already.
Let's tell them.
Under Computer. Okay, it's My Computer in XP and Computer in Vista in 7.
Yep. Or under the control panel, go to system and then system properties. If we're talking Windows XP. Well, there's this advanced
Yes.
system properties there too, actually.
Yeah.
But it's just really under system if you go there through the control panel.
Now, under there, you'll find computer name, domain, and work group settings. Click Change Settings, and then you may need your administrator password depending on how your UAC is set. Click the Computer Name tab and then click Change. Alternatively, you can just click Network ID to use the Join a Domain or Work Group wizard to automate the process of connecting to a domain and creating a domain user account on your computer. So, that's does any does everybody understand the difference between a domain and a home group?
Makes sense.
Any questions so far? Awesome. Okay, the next another feature in professional and above is Windows XP mode. Now, this is a virtual environment on which you can run various applications as if you were still in Windows XP. I'm not sure how accessible that is, so I think I would advise you use something like VMware if you were going to run a virtual environment on your computer. And Windows 7 machines tend to have the grunt to do that, as Kate is experienced because she has successfully is successfully running a virtual machine at the moment. But basically, that's what XP mode is. It's a virtual environment on your system, which makes it, I suppose, a form of compatibility mode, but not the actual Windows compatibility mode. And I'm going to talk about this here, even though it's a general feature of Windows, because you also need to know about it for your exam. Remember the modes we discussed in Chapter 5? Real mode, virtual real mode, compatibility mode, all those? Well, you need to know about compatibility mode. If you're having trouble with running an older program in Windows 7, you can use the Compatibility Troubleshooter. This is directly from Chapter 5 notes. It's a specific Windows 7 feature. 1. Click Start, Control Panel. 2. In the search box, type Troubleshooter and click Troubleshooting in the list displayed. 3. Under Programs, click Run Programs made for previous versions of Windows and click Next. Windows searches for compatibility issues and a list of programs is displayed. 4. Four. Select the program you are having problems with and click Next. If the program is not listed, select Not Listed and then Next, and then browse to locate the program and then click Open and then Next. 5. You can choose Try Recommended Settings to run the program using the settings that Windows 7 has determined to be the most compatible, or you can also choose Troubleshoot Program, which allows you to select troubleshooting steps based on the problems that you noticed. 6. Click Start the program to see if the problem is solved. 7. Click Next for Windows to apply the settings permanently, or repeat the process to choose different settings until compatibility is reached. You can also run the Program Compatibility Troubleshooter by right-clicking the program's shortcut or icon and then choose Troubleshoot Compatibility, which is of course much quicker. Good old Cisco for using the convoluted approach as usual. Okay, that's compatibility, and you can read more about that and clarify that more in Chapter 5. Another feature of Windows Professional and above is location-aware printing. I think this is rather cool. With this feature, you can pin a specific printer to a specific network. So for instance, if you're connected regularly to more than one network, as you would be at home and at work with your laptop, you can specify a default printer which will automatically be selected when you're connected to the given network. And you can do this under the Devices and Printers menu, so I think that's rather neat. Right, Windows 7 Ultimate. Any questions before we go on to the last version of Windows 7? Cool, okay, let me just skip past these hardware requirements because they're pretty much the same. Right, a couple of features, BitLocker and the ability to switch between any of 35 languages. Now, the latter is pretty self-explanatory, so I'm not going to mention that, but you do need to know it for the exam. Windows 7 Ultimate has the ability to switch between 35 languages, and that is not present in smaller versions of Win 7. And it's a good choice for people who need security, share media, and run multiple business applications. So let's talk a bit about BitLocker, because it's a little bit mysterious. Now, BitLocker can integrate with a trusted platform module on the motherboards, and who remembers what the trusted platform module is?
It's
in Chapter 9.
Chip.
Yep.
On a motherboard that stores secure information.
Exactly. Yep, it does. It keeps all of your encryption keys and all that kind of thing. So you don't actually need the TPM to operate BitLocker, but it's very handy if you do, because it means it seals all your encryption keys and things, and makes the utility a bit more flexible than it otherwise would. Right. Now, with BitLocker turned on, everything you saved is automatically encrypted. However, the qualifier is that you must have two partitions, a hidden system partition, which will remain unencrypted, of course, to allow Windows to start, because otherwise you'd be having difficulties, and an OS partition, operating system partition, that is, that you can encrypt. Now, it seems from my research that Win 7 Ultimate already creates these for you when you turn BitLocker on, but there's also a wizard which will let you create your system partition yourself. With BitLocker, you can encrypt an entire drive rather than just individual files. Under other systems of Windows, EFS support, you can only encrypt individual files or maybe folders, but you can encrypt entire drives with BitLocker. The gotcha is that your files will only remain encrypted while they're stored on the encrypted drive. So that's a bit of a bummer. If you move them to an unencrypted drive, they'll again be unsecured. You can, however, also have removable flash drives encrypted, which is a new feature. Okay, and that is the end of my tour of the various versions of Windows 7. I hope that I've now made some of these stranger-sounding features a little bit more real for you, so that they'll be easier to remember. Any questions before I just touch on little bits and pieces of installation? We've done this ad infinitum, especially over the last week, but I'll just have a quick word about it before moving on to UAC and then closing. Okay, before I mention installation, I want to mention something I actually haven't put in my notes, because you also need to be aware of it. Of course, you've just seen all the hardware requirements that Windows 7 needs, and they're very minimal. A good way to determine whether your computer will handle Windows 7 is to use something called the Microsoft Upgrade Advisor. Now, that again has been mentioned, I think, both in Chapters 5 and 12, but it's a program that you download from the MS website and run, and it will give you a report on how your hardware configuration is holding up and what changes, if any, need to occur before you can run Windows 7 on your machine. And in the same way, if you want to determine that a business system network can migrate to Windows 7, you can use something called the Microsoft Assessment and Planning Toolkit. Now, Cisco doesn't say a lot about that, but just remember its name. It's the Microsoft Assessment and Planning Toolkit.
Again, well, we might as well tell them.
Chapter 5 notes. Mm-hmm.
That's the reason why we're doing this lecture, is because Cisco didn't mention a hell of a lot that's you're going to need to know if you're to pass this exam. So that's why we're doing it.
Well, it and does actually mention it, but it's all scattered all over the curriculum.
It's all scattered, and you don't think of it. You know, yeah, exactly. You don't think of it. You think, oh, well, I might have remembered that from Chapter 5 so many weeks ago, and Chapter something else here and there. But it is.
I did say that at the beginning of lecture.
Mm, exactly.
Okay. Now, as you now know, there are myriad ways you can get Windows 7 onto a machine. Of course, there's a default installation, which involves putting in the DVD and following the bouncing ball, pretty much. There's the good old unattended installation, which involves filling out an answer file, which you get by installing the Automated Installation Kit, AIK. And of course, you can do it over a network in various ways. Let's quickly review how you do this over a network, because we've not really mentioned the generic way of doing it since Chapter 5. I went over a whole heap of ways of getting XP onto a system over a network last week, because that is the default system that Cisco still uses. But these are some general instructions which apply to all versions of Windows. And the first step in these instructions is also a test alert. So, number one, prepare the computer by creating a FAT or FAT32 partition of at least 1.5 gig. Don't ask me why it has to be FAT32 when your Windows 7 file format is in NTFS, although I believe some discussion about this did happen on the discuss list a while back. But you have to create a FAT32 partition of at least 1.5 gig. You must also make the partition bootable and include a network client. You can use a bootable disk that contains a network client so that the computer can connect to a file server over the network. So you need to know that. That's step one, and it's also a test alert. Two, once you've done that, you copy the appropriate Windows installation files from the installation disk to the network server and make sure to share the directory so the clients can connect and use the files. Three, then you boot the computer and connect to the shared directory. And then four, from the shared directory, run the appropriate setup program, and the setup program copies all of the installation files from the network share onto your hard drive. After the installation files have been copied, the procedure will continue much the same as if the installation were performed from a disk. And that's all from your Chapter 5 notes. Any questions before I just say a little word about the user account control? Okay, there's not much you actually need to know about this. Now, all you need to really remember is that, unlike Windows Vista, where the UAC has only two states, on or off, Windows 7 offers you four different stages of the UAC according to your preferences. So, if you find that the settings are too high, you can lower them without actually turning the thing off, which gives you, of course, much more flexibility. I personally would turn the thing off anyway, because I'm like that, but hey, you've got much more choice. By default, the user account control is set to the second highest option, which is notify me only when programs try to make changes to my computer, and don't notify me when I make changes to Windows settings.
I was just going to mention that it's a little bit more friendly, if you want of a better way of putting it, than what it was in Vista.
You've got four options now. What you need to remember here is that, unlike Windows Vista, where the UAC has only two states on and off, Windows 7 offers you four different stages of the UAC according to your preference. Okay, that's all from me.
Sorry, Kylie, but I just wanted to mention that in a brief that I heard about Windows 7 prior to its release, it was one of the things that was mentioned about here on the ABC, that Microsoft actually listened to the population, because it was such a problem, the UAC in its previous version. It was one of the things that put people off buying Vista, was the fact that, you know, people were getting nagged every time they wanted to breathe. So it was one of the changes, along with a host of other technical issues, that Microsoft actually do admit to saying that they listened to the user base before they released 7.
Now, for the purposes of the exam, all you really need to know is that Windows 7 has these various states of UAC control, so you can lower it without turning it off if necessary. Okay, and that's all from me. We've covered the minimum hardware requirements. I've introduced you to some features. We've touched on installation and UAC, and now that we've reached the desktop, we can move on to talk about the various other features that are available, and I will leave Elise to do that for you.
Great, thanks, Kylie. My grov button's playing up, but it's all good. Windows 7 was brought out, and a lot of the things that you find in Windows 7 are answers to problems that people are having in Windows Vista, due to its the interface and the fact that the operating system just really became too unwieldy back in 2006, which was part of its demise, apart from technical problems, usability issues, etc., and that's why it wasn't as successful as 7. But fortunately, 7's come along. Microsoft badly needed Windows 7 to come along because the other two operating systems were starting to get a bit of a foothold, and it was basically do or die there for a little while for Microsoft. So 7's come out on the market. Some of the things that I'm going to talk about are the desktop and some, I guess you might say, gimmicky things about Windows. The reason we're going to talk about it is because, yes, this exam is here. There isn't really curriculum based on it, which is why we came together today to do the Windows 7 lecture. But some of these desktop features, the exam's riddled with questions about it. I'm going to be blunt with you guys. The exam is riddled with questions, and I could see this coming a mile off. People were going to really fall over with this. So that's why we chose to do a special lecture on it. It's riddled with questions regarding these new features. And although we're vision impaired, it's probably worth us discussing them because we do live in a sighted world, and as such, we do have to support people, whether they be friends and family, colleagues, etc. And I don't know how many times I've had to adjust my way of thinking when I've been helping a sighted friend or colleague over the phone. Now, in the system, in the exam for this, you are going to have to be aware of which version supports some of these features. And I think Kylie's gone over some of that. Part of my lack of concentration was I have been having a bit of a hunt and peck through the exam, even though I've seen it, but it's just nice to sort of be aware of it while I'm presenting this lecture, because frankly, there are traps for the unwary, especially for the unwary vision impaired person. Now, it's also worth pointing out that some of the features I'm about to mention may differ when running a screen enlargement software like ZoomText or a screen reading package like JAWS or WindowEyes, because what happens is Windows switches in a different set of colours, and some of which may not allow the transparency options to go. The transparency options, I call them, are really the title bar of a window is often transparent, so you can see the wallpaper behind it. Looks like a bit of frosted glass with a bit of tint in it, actually. The Alt-Tab dialog box, as your Alt-Tab, has a transparent background in it. And some of these windows, as they're switched in and out and are rendered to the screen, will actually fade on and fade off. Now, none of that can run with a screen reader. So you'll get a nice looking desktop, but all of those transparent type features will get switched out, and the title bar just goes back to being a pale blue color or whatever color the scheme dictates. It's more of a solid way of the rendition of the windows are more solid on the screen as they were back in Windows XP and prior. What else can I talk about here? Yeah, semi-opaque I've written here, semi-transparent or semi-opaque, whichever way you want to do it. So you get a 100% capacity of all your taskbars and stuff when you've got a standard colour scheme or a colour scheme that Windows will support, or that screen readers will support. Many vision impaired people, particularly blind people, to facilitate efficiency, Kim does this, I know, will switch it back to the more classic colour scheme that was available in Windows 2000 and makes it look like Windows XP with the classic scheme. So there's always that too. Okay, now Arrow is something that Kylie's already mentioned. Are there any questions just before I get started? All right. Okay. These Arrow features, A-E-R-O, is basically, that's the default theme when you sort of set Windows up for the first time. You'll get this default theme. I actually haven't played with it because we have an Australian theme here that I like to use, so that's what we've got. Okay, one of the things is a thing called Arrow Peak. This will allow you to view the icons and gadgets on the desktop by pointing the mouse to the extreme right-hand end of the taskbar, And it's probably a good way, if you know that it's there, you might be able to get somebody to at least quickly look at the desktop. It's probably not that functional, because the moment the sighted user, for example, moves the mouse back away from the extreme right-hand edge of the taskbar, they're not going to click on the icons anyway, so you really might as well teach them about good old Windows M or Windows D. Okay. Now, hang on. Oh, yes, and it does it by making the windows transparent. It actually keeps the windows there. That's what I've got a footnote here. This actually, does this work with JAWS? I don't think it did. Hang on. No, it doesn't work with JAWS, but the version of it where you click on the left, on the right-hand end of the taskbar does. Hang on, let's get back to my notes. Okay. Now, so the transparent windows thing showing you the desktop, it's almost like turning the windows into a, almost like a pane of glass. If anyone can remember, if anyone knows what it's like to see light reflecting off a glass pane, it's probably a little bit like that. So it just sort of turns the windows, and you see a very, very faint outline of the windows, and you sort of see a bit of a wishy-washy thing where the windows were. So it's completely non-functional once you've switched in that color scheme, but I guess it's I really don't know why you'd want to use it, to be blunt, but it's there, and I have a feeling it's mentioned in the exam, because I think I saw a question there regarding it will only work as long as you've got the a grunty enough graphics card to support it. So if you don't have a grunty enough graphics card, it may not work. Are there any questions about AeroPeak before I move on to one that I actually do like, and that is what's the next one I got here? Oh, Shake. Yeah. Okay. Before I move on to Shake, is there any questions, John? Go ahead.
You referred to the exam. Are you referring to the Chapter 12 exam or something that's higher than Chapter 12?
Well, some clown decided to put a chapter Windows 7 exam in here, as I've often been referring to it as, and didn't write a curriculum for it. So there is another exam. It's been decided by people like Grace and Kylie that the exam is compulsory to do in order to pass this course. So I said, well, we really need to have a lecture for it if you're going to have an exam for it. So that's what we did. So, yeah, there is a Windows 7 exam. It is available as of now. You can take it when you feel ready. And Kylie will just treat it like any of the other exams. When she puts up her normal exams, she'll put this up as well. So you'll see it there as of now.
Thank you.
Yeah, so it is important that you at least know that it's there, because I just have an aversion to springing things on people. All right. Okay,
it is a slightly larger exam.
Yes. 32 questions
instead of 20. But that's okay, you still have a whole 2 hours to complete, and I doubt if any of you have got anywhere near that for any of your module exams. So don't panic, you still have a long time to complete.
Look on the bright side, guys. It gives a bit more breathing space in case you get one of these things wrong. You know, if you get a question wrong in a 20-question exam, it will take more off your mark. If you get one or two questions wrong in a 32-question exam, you don't have as much, because it's done on percentages, you see.
Good point.
There you go. My sociologist friend always did tell me I looked at the world in a different way. All right, Shake. Gillian, for your information, Kylie. Shake lets you minimise all windows not being used, and this does actually work with JAWS, although you can actually see it a little bit slower because of the fact that JAWS is running, and you know the graphics card operates a bit differently with JAWS running. But suffice it to say, if you have a window that is not maximized, in other words, a window in its restored state, and a window in its restored state is a window that does not take up the entirety of the screen, so you can maybe see bits behind it, you can click on the left, you can click on the title bar of the window. And then when the terminology or the vernacular often is, oh, you click on a window and you do something with it. Well, I've actually expanded my notes when I wrote this up on the weekend, basically to say that you really click on the title bar of the window by positioning the mouse over the title bar and holding the left mouse button down. And then you can pick, that's how sitelinks pick up their windows and move them around the screen. So what you can do in Windows 7 is do this by putting the mouse over the title bar and simply literally shaking it, and Windows detects the rapid mouse movement and will basically minimize everything that's behind the window in question. So there you go. Again, I'm not entirely sure what it would do. In actual fact, it's probably good for some people like my uncle, for example, who Kylie and Kim know up in Darwin, who seems to think it's a cool idea to read my auntie everything that's going on the window that's poking out from behind the current one. So if I ever had to assist him with Windows 7, I'd say just shake the current window and kill everything behind it, because he doesn't understand the concept of a focused window. And I'm always saying to my uncle, I'm not interested in the window that's behind the window that we're looking at, just the current window. So it could be good for that. If you're dealing with a sightling who's not of an advanced usage of Windows. Okay. Any questions?
It's also actually good because good old Windows M does the same thing for us. And so it's finally they've got a mouse click that's as quick as that for a change.
Well, Windows M actually does more than that. It actually minimises all windows. This one only minimises all but the current window. Sorry, Kate, go ahead.
So if you wanted to then minimise that again, can you do the same process? So once it's maximised, you go on the title bar and shake it and it'll minimise?
Okay, this does not work if the window is maximised. As I said, it works when the window is in a restored state. There's three states a window can be in. One is maximized, which is taking up the entirety of the screen. Restored, where the window takes up a portion of the screen. And minimized, of course, which is minimized to the taskbar.
Yeah, so what I'm saying is, would you be able to shake that back to its original state?
Okay, no, you haven't got it. The way it, hang on, this damn grob key, right. Okay, what it does is it minimises all windows but the window you're working with. For example, let's say we had a Word document on the screen that I'm reading my notes from, for example. I might, because I'm a web developer and I've got 20,000 projects running at once, I might have a couple of web browsers running. There might be the Ventrilo client running because I'm here doing the lesson, etc., etc. And there could even be an email client running. Now, because I've got such a wide screen, I don't necessarily have to have all of these maximized. So I like my screen real estate. So these windows are going to be poking out from behind my notes, for example. Then I'm reading my notes. And so I get, for example, the mouse onto the Microsoft Word window, and I shake it all about, do the hokey pokey, and all of the windows except for the Word window will minimise. So all of the junk behind the Word window on my notes will go away, and I'll just see the nice Sydney Harbour Bridge or something as my desktop, sticking out from behind my notes. Is that making sense?
Yeah, I get that, but what I'm getting at is then how do you get things to go back how they were before?
Oh, how do you get it to go back? I think you're right, actually. Let me just test it. Hang on. I'm just testing it. It's actually a bit hairy because I've got JAWS running. Let me just shut JAWS.
I suspect it's a toggle.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get at.
Hang on, stand by. Yeah, it is. It is a toggle. What had actually happened is there are some instances it doesn't work, and one such instance is if a window, like I had my key manager sitting there behind it, and it had a dialog box open. So a program with a dialog box open, which was one of the records I was looking at to log into a website prior to lecture, was still focused from that program, so it couldn't quite disappear. So yes, you're right, Kate, it is a toggle.
Sorry. Thank you.
Any other questions concerning Shake? And, oh, yeah, I'll ask for questions, and there's one more point I want to mention. Silence is golden. That's what we say. Hey, last year, girlfriend. All right. Now, Shake is one of those things that I think I've actually mentioned this, may not work terribly well without the right sort of graphics card. So you do need some reasonably good hardware. I think there are some questions about it in the exam that, no, the user noticed Shake isn't working well. I'd just say get on with your life would be my answer, but the Cisco answer will be something different. All right. Snap is one I actually do like, and I did pick this up off a document that Dean Adams put around the discussion list late last year with, you know, sort of something like U-Boot, you know, 50 fantastic tips for the new Windows 7 user that he put around. Now, Snap is, there's two snaps actually. There's two snaps. There's the mouse version and then there's a keyboard version. We'll deal with the mouse one first. Again, in the notes, It's mentioned in Chapter 5. Respectfully, I don't think Cisco articulated it terribly well, so here's my version of it. Snap, again, is putting the mouse on the title bar of your window and dragging the mouse so that the mouse pointer goes off the screen. Not necessarily the window goes off the screen, but the mouse pointer goes off the screen. When that occurs, what will happen is a bluish area will appear, which denotes the area that the window will now take up once you let go of the mouse, a bit like a preview, for example. Now, what Snap's all about, and the keyboard is probably a bit nicer in this, is that Snap will allow you to get a current window and make it take up precisely half the width of your screen. So, you could, for example, have a Skype window with a picture in it from somebody on a webcam, and you can snap that to, say, the right-hand side of the screen, and you could have your email or your work or whatever you're working on the left-hand side of the screen. And in this day and age, with people running widescreen formats, the 16:9 format most of the time now, it does allow for some usable screen real estate. So again, same thing with going to the right, you drag the mouse pointer on the title bar to the right of the screen. When the mouse disappears, it will put up a bluish area that denotes the preview of the newly sized window, and then it will sort of sit on the right hand side of the screen. The keystrokes for this actually are quite nifty. So, incidentally, you let go when you like the preview. You know, if the preview occurs, you say, I like what it's going to look like, I let go. All right, Snap has some interesting keystrokes, which I rather like. Windows key plus left arrow will snap your application to the left, to the center of the screen. So the left-hand end of your window will be, left-hand side of your window will obviously jammed up against the left-hand side of the screen, and it will go to roughly, pretty much precisely, I think, halfway across the screen. And if you were to use the Windows key, Windows key plus right arrow, it would do the same to the window going right. So you'd have your active window, let's say, going from the right of the screen to the middle. Windows key plus up arrow maximizes the window to fill the entire screen. So if you are finding that your sightling user is being distracted by junk going on behind the window and you can't be bothered getting them to shake the window, get them to hold the Windows key down and go right, go up arrow, and that will just force it to maximize and thus take the distraction away. And Windows key plus down arrow actually puts the window into the restored state, which we've already discussed what the restored state is. Are there any questions?
By the way, that feature is even available in Windows Starter, which is kind of cool.
That's handy to know. Yeah, I actually quite like those snap functions. That's pretty much it, but I did actually do a section here, if you don't mind, girlfriend on gadgets, even though they're not mentioned, but I think we don't just want to do this for the exam's sake, because you never know, somebody's likely to make a new version of the exam next year and put different forms up. And also sightlings like gadgets. Is it all right just to do a small section on that?
Yeah, that's why I said event viewer as well, because it's not in the exam either, but we needed to cover it because that's what, you know, it's important. But yeah, gadgets, because there are differences between how they're handled in Vista and how they're handled in 7. Vista has them on a sidebar and 7 has them on the desktop. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, once again, Microsoft listened and made the usability of Windows 7 a little bit nicer, which was really cool, because they do appear properly on the desktop. They may or may not appear, in actual fact. I think using the standard color scheme on Windows 7 will make them not, as in like the classic, because I know every time I've tandem into Kim's computer, I never see the gadgets there, so I don't know. Have you switched those off, Kim, or is it just that you never bothered switching them on? Or what's happened with your desktop gadgets?
I think I turned them off.
Yeah, well, that's understandable, because they are a bit tricky to get onto with JAWS, and pretty much, if you're totally blind, almost a waste of time. But having said that, there is in the JAWS tutorials in the Windows JAWS for Windows Vista that comes with JAWS 11 and JAWS 12 Daisy Book. You will find there is a tutorial there on how to actually navigate those gadgets with JAWS. It's been about 6 months since I've listened to it, so I couldn't tell you what those keystrokes are, but they are available if you care to look them up. Gadgets are small areas of the screen, or small sort of windows, that are designed to denote or to display minimal and precise information. That is, if you find a clock gadget, it's a clock. It's not meant to be a clock and a calendar and a weather machine, or it's not meant to be a clock that displays, 25 different time zones. It is only meant to display the current relevant information to you. Same with the weather gadget. It's only meant to sort of show you basic information. For example, whether it's, like 25 degrees outside, your own location, unless you tell it that you want to know what the weather is in another location. And it will have a picture of a sky behind it that has either a sun in it if it's sunny, or a cloudy background if it's cloudy, and that brightness of which will change depending on whether it's night time or dark time. You'll see the clouds go darker. In actual fact, I think I saw one the other night with a moon in it. So there you go.
I think the key point about gadgets is that they're dynamically updated. So they're a dynamic piece of screen real estate that's always being updated. Like a clock's time is always changing. The weather information is always changing. So a gadget's info is always is dynamic.
Yep, and there are actually some standards for the creation of gadgets. They're meant to be, precise information that regularly updates, and they are not meant to also be platforms from which to launch programs or from which to access interfaces. For example, if anyone's running Avast, Kim and I are, but Kim won't ever actually see this, you can actually click on the Avast gadget, which will bring up the Avast user interface, the spyware antivirus program. That, in my reading of the rules, is actually in direct violation of what a gadget does. If you want quick and easy access to a program, you use a desktop icon or something from the quick launch or something from the system tray. So that's a little bit there on gadgets. As I said, you can get them for all different things, as Kylie said. So, if it's a clock, it's a clock. If it's a calendar, it's a calendar. And that's pretty much it. Okay, any questions before moving on to things like device stage? In addition to the device manager, good old device manager from previous versions of Windows, Windows actually has two other ways of managing devices. One is a thing in control panel called devices and printers. The other one is the device stage. Now you can, within the control panel, you can from the application there, access printers and that sort of stuff and right click on the device and get its properties. But device stage is something that can be accessed by clicking its relevant icon in the taskbar. I just typed it in on the Windows search, which I think is absolutely fantastic. Type in anything you want from Windows and you don't have to worry about learning how to find it or where Microsoft put it. Oh yes, don't get me started on the way they set the control panel up in Windows 7, because by default it's unusable. Switch it back to list view and get on with your life. Device stage is a new way of handling devices. For example, digital cameras, removable media. It allows you access to common tasks, like if you've got a media player, for example, synchronizing files with the media player and that sort of stuff. I haven't really played with it a great deal. I sort of took a quick interest in it Sunday afternoon when I typed these notes up. It will also allow you to install new software updates for a particular device. So there you go. If you've got something on your computer that you regularly have and Windows knows that there's an updated driver or something for that device, it will allow you to do it from the device stage. I seem to remember it's mentioned in some of the Cisco curriculum that I've looked at. Remembering I've not actually taught the 4.1 curriculum, so I'm only sort of familiar with it via Kylie.
Not a very good mention, unfortunately, which is why we're doing it here. Hardly a mention at all, really.
Yes, I seem to think I saw it in the exam again. That's what happens when you do a service pack on a course. Look, massive patches and upgrades. It's probably time for version change again. As Kylie said, they've made all these changes to our course here, the IT1 course, to bring it more in line with CompTIA. So it's really a new way of interacting with your devices. Any questions on the device stage, gang?
Does it only come with certain versions of Windows?
I'm led to believe it's there with all versions. Would that be right, Kylie? Certainly there on the home, premium, and the professional one that I've got here.
Device, yes, it is. As far as I know, it is. Yeah.
Oh, it's just that I went to try and look for it just now and I couldn't find it.
What version of Windows are you running?
I've got Home Premium.
It'll be there. Now, the Task Manager, good old Task Manager, Control, Alt, Delete. Rather than bringing up the Task Manager right away, which is what happened in Windows 7, Windows XP and Windows 2000, etc., is it will bring up a screen similar to that of the Welcome screen. And one of the options on that is the Task Manager, of course. When you select Task Manager, the desktop and all its icons and many windows will come back. And the task manager will be there as it was in previous versions of Windows. But it does have one extra piece of functionality, and you're going to love it, gang. It has a new tab, and the tab is called Services. Yep, no more messing around under administrative tools. Just go Control or Delete and start Task Manager. You can get to your services right away. There you go.
I'm jelly.
Yeah. Anything, that's about all I've mentioned here, girlfriend. I think you asked me to stick it in the notes the other day, and that's about all I did. Was there anything else I should have elaborated on with the task manager?
No, we just need to reiterate, you know, folks, what are services? What can you name a couple of services for me? Well, one's the print spooler. Can you think of any more? Remember what the print spooler is for? Okay, I remember a couple of
print
you had
spooler
this.
Is
it? Yeah.
Print spooler is where your data goes to your RAM in your printer before it's printed. No. Yeah, yes.
Yeah, it's sort of like a holding area for print jobs as they're queued up. So, yeah, it's either probably usually space on the hard drive or RAM, I suppose. I'm not sure. The print spooler should be stopped and started in the event of some problems, and there's actually a little exam question about that, which, to be quite blunt, probably would have been quite okay in other exams pertaining to other versions of Windows, because we sort of started doing that in Windows XP when we had problems with the print spooler. So watch out for that, gang.
There are notes on services in Chapter 12, so just review
those.
Yeah,
so have a look at the Chapter 12. I actually haven't read Chapter 12 in this curriculum, so there you go. As I said, I taught the old one. I've been pretty busy, sorry about that, gang. So yeah, read the chapter 5 and 12 notes. I think will probably serve you well. What do you think, Kylie? Yep, just make sure you do that.
Yeah, as I said in my intro, yep, review chapter 5 and 12.
Yep,
for good measure.
Just can't reiterate that enough. Okay, now about Event Viewer, I've written here. Is there any reason you wanted me to talk about that? Somebody, what's the
There's so much more you can do with it under 7 than you could with earlier versions of Windows.
There is.
I
had
a bit
of I haven't actually played with it under this version up until this morning when I knocked off.
Maybe we should all have a play. How about we do it right here and now, folks? Why not?
Yeah, we could.
I mean, we've got a heap of time.
Hang on. You want me to talk people through a piece of software I've hardly played with? Because I can damn sure you're not going to do it.
We've got a ton of time.
Yeah, well, I've got gating issues here. I'd rather not, actually. Hold on.
I have it open, and it's a list.
Yeah, let's see if Enterprise doesn't bloody work.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it's to be blunt, I've probably not... there's different views. I haven't really played with it, to be blunt. I haven't needed to. I did export a report from it earlier today. It's quite powerful by the looks of it. It's got a number of different window panes. There's a summary of administrative events is one of the window panes. There's errors, warnings. They appear as I'm doing this visually, so I've got no idea what the JAWS is like to navigate it because I'm holding the grov key down while I talk. There's three views here for that. Recently viewed notes. Windows logs and stuff, that could be good. There's a log summary pane here. Now, on the left-hand side of the event viewer, there is a tree view that would conform to the normal tree view. And I'll see. Yeah, it is JAWSable. It's custom views. You've got event viewer, local, left parent, right parent. Custom views has a administrative events thing in it, and then all of this refreshes that right-hand pane of the window, so it will take a little bit of time to render it to the screen. There's another category here on the tree view called Windows Logs. Applications comes under Windows Logs, as does Security. So it's a bit similar in that respect to Windows, the XP version. You can right click on those and export a report in CSV or text or some other versions. There's a setup. Again, whilst I'm cursing these down, changing the main part of the window, which means we could probably tab across to these, I guess. Hang on. Yes, it does work when I'm holding the grov key down. That's good. When in the right hand, the main part of the window, if you're tabbing between the panes, many of those form list views. When I tab here, I've got no idea where I've ended up on some button. There's actually a right-hand pane. There's actually three panes. There's the left-hand tree view, there's the main pane, and some right-hand pane, which I've got no idea what it does. So, like I said, you're going to ask me to preview, to sort of demo a piece of software I've virtually never played with. Good on you. We'll get back to this visually. What else can we do? Setup is one of the options. System, I assume things system in here has a lot of information about things that are happening in the background. I'm, as I said, not really familiar with it. It's quite powerful. Forward events is here. I've got no idea what that is. Don't ask. And that's all under the Windows log section of the tree view. Applications and services also expand down to another half dozen items, which are hardware events, I guess. And it hasn't populated the screen yet, unless it's empty. Nothing probably drastically wrong with this machine. Internet Explorer has its own entry under there. Surprise, surprise. Key management services, whatever that does. Media center. These have got nothing in them, so it's probably telling me that there's no conflicts or problems with my hardware, and I can just see that visually. There's a Microsoft group here that's subordinate with a Windows subsection, and I'm not going to go through the Windows subsection because there's all sorts of things like API, and there's about a billion of them. But on the next level up, still within the applications and services part of the tree view, is the Windows PowerShell, and I've not had a chance to play with Windows PowerShell. I believe it's reasonably powerful and functional. There's stuff in there pertaining to that. And on the extreme top of the tree view, there is something called subscriptions, and it renders nothing much other than a pretty blank screen. So that is the event viewer, done by somebody who hardly knows how to use it.
It's a very handy tool, though, if you want to look at what's happening in your machine. For instance, I had warning that something had been installed on my machine that I didn't install myself the other day, so the first place I went was my event log to see what it was.
Yes, and I have to say that when I was doing this as a student with Windows XP, there was a hell of a lot less of it. So there you go. So there you go, girlfriend. It's a lot more in it than what you're used to over there with your Windows XP box.
That's why I asked you to do the Windows 7. Yeah.
Good on you. Yeah, all right. There it is. I haven't had need to play with it. As I said, it's probably very, very good, and I don't want to take anything away from Microsoft or anybody for enhancing it because it's... It looks like it's quite powerful. It's just that I haven't had the chance to really use it. I did export a report like you would in Windows XP. I did actually export a report before to a CSV file and had a quick look at it in Excel. So you can still do all that sort of stuff, which is good. You can probably export reports on what the desktop gadget for the local weather's doing or something. It's so bloody powerful.
Can I ask a question?
You may.
Under the custom view, there's the administrative events, and when you tab over, it has a whole list of, well, mine's got nearly 2,000 entries, of different things that it's calling errors and that. What are you able to do with those? Are you able to clear those, or are you able to actually use those reports
sort of things that would be printed... Yeah, there's sort of things that would end up being printed in the report if you actually right-click on that heading, which I forgot what it was. I think if you can go to export, you would be able to export all that data. So if you don't want to export it, you can just see it running in real time. And a technician often does, you know, even with the older version, rather than exporting a report, if they didn't need to, they might just have a look in the event viewer and maybe either see what's running in real time, or they would probably, you know, scroll down the list and sort of see what's been happening on the machine for the last, you know, 24, 38, 48 hours sort of thing.
If you press enter on the event, it will give you a bit more information about that. So the error, for instance, it will come up with an event ID, and you can actually Google that to see what the error means.
Yeah, oh, Charlie's I see.
Right, it did, yeah, I've just done it, and there's a whole faulting module. Firefox must have crashed earlier on. I found one here. Funny about that, Firefox did crash earlier on. So it's here in the event log, and it told us when it did it. Tells us the exception code 000, so like Kylie said, you can, you know, look up these things. So it's reasonably JAWS friendly by the looks of it. It has a read-only screen. May not be that. I'm doing so many silly things with my keyboard here. I do know it works with a virtual cursor anyway. It should theoretically work with the normal one, and you just have a close button. So if you click on one of those events and you click on the close button, the dialog goes away. We actually used Event Viewer, as Kylie would know, and Kim's probably heard the war story since I've known her. This was back in Windows XP. Jackie and I did this last year, and we had no trouble with the Event Viewer convincing a technician who sold my auntie a computer with a dud motherboard in it that the motherboard was in no fit condition to continue being a motherboard.
And you'll also get a chance to play with it in the big lab of 12.2.4. I think one of the sections you have to go back to, not as deep into the performance monitor. That's the section where NVDA is reads information better, I believe, according to the accessibility tips document. But what you get to do afterwards is go into your event viewer and actually see how it logs the starting and stopping of the service, because performance monitor is a service.
Yeah, I should probably do that worksheet. Maybe there you go, Kim. We're sitting here one night next week. We might. I'll do the worksheet with you. It's probably useful. It's probably going to teach me something. That okay? Because as I said, I think it's about the second time I've ever opened the Windows 7 Event Viewer. All right. And basically, I just wrote here a note that's really just easy, and it logs the history of what's going on and that sort of stuff.
I think you can actually integrate it with the task scheduler too, which would be rather cool.
Well, I think we'll all go into our worksheet between now and next week and find out what it actually tells us to do. Because I said that, you know, it was all different when I was a student and when I actually took this class as an instructor last year. Okay, now something that is mentioned in the exam, and I was quite taken by the mentioning of this, is talks about environment variables. Basically, all of the common operating systems like Linux, DOS, and Windows, I'm not even sure about the Mac, probably not, who knows, that wasn't mentioned when I Googled it up earlier today, have things known as environment variables. An environment variable is basically a set of dynamic name values that can affect the way running processes will behave. So you can have a variable with a file name with a path in it, for example. And usually, when you see percent, Kylie? Percent where the percent username in a path will denote, say, for example, C:\Users\Username, for example. So you can, the system will set, in my case at least, to match the at least on my computer as a user, so that it will be the variable that goes in between the percent symbols. Back in DOS, we used to set environment variables so that if we typed in a command at the command prompt, for example, DOS was pretty dumb, didn't know where the commands were, but if we set what we used the path environment variable, we could put in a path and the system would know to look in that path or in any of the directories in that path for the command. We used to have a bin directory, for example, and if you were in C:\Bin, you could type in the command name of a file that was in there and it would run. But if you weren't in C:\Bin, but you needed that file to run, you would either have to type C:\Bin\command name, etc., etc., or if the bin directory was in the path, you would just simply type the command name and the system would find it. That was a path environment variable. Windows XP, actually, I was going to bring them up. Another path environment variable is to tell Windows where the temp directory is. Often the temp directory may occur under the user's directory, especially for temporary internet files. So that's obviously going to be a variable, something that changes. So it's not going to be the same for all computers, because all computers have got people with different usernames on them. Basically can be set to create basically an operating environment for different things. We have an environment variable that is show non-present devices, that makes the device manager show up all sorts of nice little things that you would otherwise not see. Once you set that environment variable, the device manager becomes a lot more functional. I won't go into all the notes, it's just a bit stuff here, but you will need to probably look those up, have a bit of a look at what environment variables are on the net before you do your exam. I think there was a question there, something to do with users and that sort of stuff. I can't remember now, I'd have to go back.
It's exactly just a rote question that Cisco has drawn out for the exam, which is why we thought it would be better if we covered it a little bit here, so you could actually understand the question and not just try to learn the silly thing by rote.
Yeah, it just basically sets an environment for a set of tasks, of programs, etc. Basically, it's just like your environment, really. Any questions? BitLocker. BitLocker only comes with Windows Ultimate, so watch out for that. It, I don't even know what it does. It was messing with the motherboard thing you said. Kylie would probably know more about it than me, because she studies the curriculum better than I do.
It's drive encryption, as I said earlier. It's a way of encrypting your whole drive, and you can even encrypt your flash drives with it, which is very cool. It's something that's you haven't had available for the home user before. It's only been available for businesses or enterprise versions of Windows in the past. So it's kind of neat. You can encrypt whole drives.
Yeah. Sorry, Kate, go ahead.
I was going to say it'd be really good for people who do work at home and in the office, because they might be working on sensitive files, they might be lawyers or policemen or something like that, and it would mean that if anything went wrong with their home laptop, people wouldn't be able to get hold of that data.
And of course it makes it more difficult when you're on the network for hackers to get into it as well, because they can get in but they can't actually access your file.
Yeah, that's right. And your home network's probably more liable to be suspect to hacking than your work one.
Only gotcha, well, though, and I think it's a big one, is that once you move the files off onto an unencrypted drive, they are unsecured again. So the files are only secure as long as they remain on the drive you've encrypted.
Yep.
Now, and as long as you transfer them to another encrypted drive.
I would say so, exactly. Yeah. Now, as somebody said just then, it's only available to, it's first time it's been available in the home. Well, there's still a lot of people using Home Premium, though. I don't know what it costs to buy the Windows Ultimate one, or Windows Professional, for example. See, I've got Professional on the Vostro. I've got home premium on this. So to be honest, I think even unless people want to go and buy Ultimate for the home environment, it's still out of the reach for home people. There is the Windows Upgrade Anytime wizard that you can fire up and upgrade your Windows, but they'll probably ask you for a payment if you do, and I've not done it, just in case any of the programs on here decide to have a big nasty because they wake up and find that it's no longer Windows Home Premium, but it's Windows Professional that they're running on, so I never bothered doing it.
It appears to me that it would be something that a business would install on an employee's laptop.
Yeah, you're probably right. Actually, just getting back to the Windows Upgrade Anytime, one of the things to be aware of, and don't know that it's covered in the exam, but it's again worth being aware of, is that the Windows that are shipped in Windows 7 are all the same Windows. The only difference is being Windows 32-bit and Windows 64-bit. They're obviously the difference, but within each of those genres, it is the same Windows that you get on the CD, on the DVD, CD, sorry, as you would get if I went to buy Windows Home Premium and I wanted to have Windows what do you call it, Windows Ultimate. The difference being is the serial number. So it knows, depending on what serial number you put in it at the installation time, as to what Windows you're going to get. So they've done that because it's better to ship one ISO image rather than in the Windows XP days and 2000 days you had, you know, Windows CDs getting around with Windows XP Professional on it and Windows XP Home and Windows XP something else Media Edition, and it just became a bit unwieldy. And of course it allows the user, like I said, to use the upgrade anytime wizard to change their version of Windows. As I said, I've never gone right through the procedure because it probably asks for a payment, etc. But it can be done online.
Well, I would say it would do, yes.
Well, of course it would. But it would just give you another key. And you can actually change the key in Windows, and that's probably one of the reasons why. So you can change the version of it just by putting in a new key, etc., relicensing it. I've just got a little other things you need to know section here, because I knew this wasn't going to take too long. There's
did you cover backups?
Backup, yep, system image. There's a question there asking you about, or words to the effect of, what are you going to do if this whole thing craters? Recover from a system image. Don't ask me how. I wouldn't know the special Microsoft way of doing it. I would probably know the Linux way of doing it better, which is what we used to do with our Windows XP boxes, didn't we, Kylie?
What that lovely Windows Secret article outlines.
Ah, well, you can talk about that because you probably read it. Go on.
Well, I read it once, but it basically, there are three different parts to the Windows backup. I might as well send you out all the all the article. That's probably what I should have done. It's just sent you the everyone the article because it makes life much easier. Then you can understand all the different parts that are involved in Windows 7's brand new backup, which is
apparently
much
it's
more powerful
come
and
a long way. It's come a long way. It's probably brought it up to the level that we've been doing outside of Windows for the last several years. And then the other thing is, because I run the Linux server here, I don't really keep valuable information on my Windows machine, so I've never really had to consider Windows backup for a bit. But those of you who do, I believe it will back up the data quite well as backing up the operating system quite well and a couple of levels in between. Network installations. There's a question about that in the exam that's probably not covered in the curriculum. I'm going to tell you now, it's something like make a small partition and put a network client on it and install from so you can connect to your network. Cisco doesn't really tell us how to do it, but what I can tell you is that we were installing Windows 95 from manual, you know, from systems like that back in the mid-1990s. So that's a network installation of Windows. So you basically make a FAT32 partition, stick a network client on it, and connect to your network and do what you have to do. As I said, I've not done it under Windows 7, and it doesn't even tell you what network client to use. So there's a question there in the exam on that one. What else is there? The Microsoft Assessment and Planning Tool, Kylie mentioned that a bit earlier. Do you want to outline that? I think it was mentioned in Chapter 5, or is it mentioned in the official Chapter 12?
It gets a small mention in Chapter 5. It basically, as I said, it's if you want to determine whether a single computer can migrate to Windows 7, you use your Upgrade Advisor. But if you want to determine whether a system, a network of computers can migrate, then you would use the Assessment and Planning Toolkit to A, determine whether the system can migrate, and B, help you plan the migration. So that's really all that Cisco has to say about it. And as far as that is concerned, that's all you need to know, although if you want to do more research, I'm sure it's out there. What I'm hoping with some of this is that your appetite has been whetted to go out and do more research or have it play around and see what happens.
Basically the Microsoft Assessment and Planning Tool is really for a network of computers, isn't it? Whereas that other one was just for one. There's a question in the exam that what happens if a program will work after you've done an upgrade? A program works before you do an upgrade to Windows 7 and no longer works. I'm going to give you the answer for that, because no one should be upgrading to Windows. You should be simply doing clean installations. The official answer is reinstall the program in access in compatibility mode.
Well, in if my you read opinion, about compatibility mode, then you know what you'd probably know about anyway, it.
Well,
so.
It's pretty bloody messy, to be blunt. All that sort of stuff. Clean installs really make your life a lot easier. There's a badly worded question in the exam about cache overflow. Ugh, who wrote this junk? Basically, I have never heard the term cache overflow in the context of Windows Internet Explorer. I do know about clearing the cache in Windows Internet Explorer by going into Internet Options, etc., etc., but I've never ever heard it referred to as cache overflow. What does cache overflow mean in this context? I've got no idea, because usually even by default settings, the amount of temporary internet files, etc., that are saved by your web browser is usually set to a percentage of the free space of your hard drive. Or you can set it right down to 1% like I do, so you lessen the risk of getting viruses and stuff.
And stuff on caching is covered in Chapter 12 under the web browser section. It's only a small section. And there's a little worksheet that you get to fiddle around with your web browsers anyway.
Well, I think half the students in this class will have done it even before they knew what the cavi was, you know, how to go in and clear your cache. So talk to the worksheet if you can't be bothered doing it, because you all know how to do it. You're all sensible people. I was just taken by the term cache overflow. It's rather interesting. I didn't know what would happen if you had too much of that junk on your hard. Well, better still just get CCleaner and run bloody CCleaner and clear the whole lot up in one fell swoop. Now, there's a question there about Arrow not working properly, which is all of those desktop-y things. So just be careful you've got the right hardware installed. When I say the right hardware, that your hardware's got enough grunt. And that, ladies and gentlemen, brings me to the end of my bit of Chapter 12 Supplemental, which is the Windows 7 bit.
So
any questions before I throw back to Kylie? Did I put you all to sleep? Makes sense. Or have I confused you and gone on about sort of cited things too much?
No, it all seemed fairly clear to me.
No.
Thank you.
It's good to know.
Yeah, well, I just take the view we live in a cited world, and look, some of these things like shake and stuff. Look, the arrow peak thing, for example, you can click on the end of the taskbar with JAWS running it, and sort of is like a Windows M. Or holding the mouse over and seeing a transparent, glassy-looking window, situation that your Windows turned into. It is beyond me what practical application some feature like that actually has, to be blunt. Why you would bother, I don't know. It's a gimmick. But they're there, and they do ask about them in the exam, and some things like shake are probably useful for, assisting your sighted counterparts and stuff, so that's one of the reasons why we thought we'd mention it all.
So, Kylie, for what we've just covered, there is an additional chapter, an additional lab, an additional test, is that correct?
No, just an additional test. That's why we did focus this lecture on Windows 7, because there's no actual chapter that goes with the Windows 7 exam, but the content is taken from all over the curriculum, which is why we've tried to bring some of it together here so that you can have a better chance of passing the Windows 7 module.
It's almost like an exam without a module, which, they're relying on the fact, I think, that they're taking the material from, I don't even know that. I correct me if I'm wrong. A lot of it is drawn from Chapter 5 and Chapter 12 and probably bits of the curriculum. But, there were certainly some things there I went, I'm pretty sure the students are not going to get. So that's why we did it.
So
I just needed it in my mind. So I got it. Thank you.
So
which means you've all got...
I'm taking it then that what we now do is that we now go for one extra week of classes?
No, just find some time to do another exam.
In your spare time.
It's a Clayton's module. It's a module you're having when you're not having a module. You know, it's... Yeah, it's just an exam for a module that doesn't exist.
This is the extra week, pretty much. I mean, because we covered Chapter 12 in 1 week. This is a bonus week that we've used to cover Windows 7. So, in effect, you get a bit of a breather. You get to sit an extra exam, but you also get 2 weeks to cover Chapter 12 as well. So, that's why we chose to do it this way, because Chapter 12 is the advanced OS chapter. So we thought Windows 7 would be good to slot in here.
So next week we'll go on to Chapter 13.
We will. Actually, we've only got 3 weeks after this to go after this, because Chapter 14 doesn't actually count in your grade, and the reason we left that out was because of Windows 7 exam. It was either cover Windows 7 exam, make it compulsory, or leave one of the advanced chapters out. And Windows 14 gives you the least build on knowledge that you've already learnt. It's another printer chapter. For those of you who want to sit the 11 to 16 final, which is optional, I'd advise that you read Chapter 14. You can even sit the exam if you want, but it doesn't count towards your grade, so we won't be teaching it. So there's Chapter 13, Chapter 15, and Chapter 16 to go, and that is it, folks.
But if anyone wants value for money, go on, Kate.
I guess that's what I was trying to get at, which chapter we were going to leave out to cater for this week. Now, are there worksheets for Chapter 14?
No. Okay.
There are, but you don't have to do them.
But you don't have to do them. Okay. If you really want to do Chapter 14, gang, here's what to do. Go back in 12 months to Elise and Jackie's version of the 4.0 curriculum and listen to that. Not only will you get Chapter 14, you'll hear a nice surprise from Radio NZ. That was the day that our friend from Radio New Zealand popped in and visited Kylie and consequently produced a radio show on the whole thing, and we got a mention on Radio New Zealand. Courtesy of 1 in 5. Remember that, girlfriend?
There's very little that you will learn from Chapter 14 that you didn't already learn in 7. Very little.
But it's good entertainment.
A couple of little technical things. Yeah, a couple of little technical things, but really not a lot. What Chapter 14 tends to focus on is troubleshooting and printers. So, if you want to read it for your own edification and even do the worksheets for your own edification, that's fine. You don't have to send them to me. You can even sit the exam if you like. If you want me to put it up there, I'm happy to do that, but it doesn't count towards your grade, so do with it what you will.
Oh, Kylie, that's all right. I just cleared up what I was...
Sorry, John?
Are you finished, Kate?
For you, I will always bow out.
Oh, golly. Kylie... Last week you said you did a lab in class. I haven't got down to that on the recording yet. What, 12.5, I believe?
12.5.3, John, because you weren't there, what I'd like you to do is just to send me a couple of paragraphs on any additional questions that you would have asked that weren't asked in class. That's all you need to do on that lab.
Okay.
My Windows desktop gadget that tells me about the Australian dollar is now telling me that one Australian dollar is worth $1.075. There you go. So we're above parity. So that's what the gadgets are for. Very, very precise information.
And the sightlings love them.
It's rather interesting, that, because the weather gadget's telling me that it's 8 degrees, that I'm in Melbourne, and that it's cloudy. I'm looking out the window and it's sunny, blue sky, and I would say it's probably more like 16 degrees. So that gadget has not updated itself probably since 8 o'clock this morning, and it's now after midday.
It's not very good, is it?
No. The clock and calendar are fine, though. May 31st, 2010. 2011, actually. There you go.
So from where Kate lives and you live in Melbourne, is that a long ways? I know you're going to... She's going to let you...
Probably about an hour on the train. What do you reckon? Okay. How far out of Melbourne are you? Are you Kate?
Whereabouts are you, Elise?
Mount Waverley. So I'm half an hour's drive to the east of the city. So, so I'm Mount Waverley.
So to drive from Elise to me is about an hour and three quarters at the very outside.
Okay, so it's more than a casual outing.
Well, I don't know. I go to Melbourne several times a
Yeah, the thing is, distances are funny here in Australia. People might take a drive for an hour or two and call that a casual drive. In Australia, that is, because everything's so sparse here. You know, there's, you know, we might take a drive to Ballarat, an hour and a half, maybe an hour and 40 minutes away, and somebody, I'm sure Ian would call it a casual drive, knowing him.
I know when my brother was in the UK and they wanted to go somewhere, and the people would say to them, "Oh, it's a long way." And he said, "Oh, how far is it?" "Oh, that's about 100 miles." And Phil said, "Oh, well, we'll have done that in an hour. What am I going to do with the rest of the day?"
Yeah, it's about 100 miles to Geelong from Melbourne, and Geelong is Victoria's second largest city, so about an hour's drive down the freeway.
Well, Kylie, if you're going to let us go, I'm going to go.
Yeah, I will. Just before we do, I'm going to embarrass you now, John. We have a star among us, folks. Our John just set his final in this past week, and the score was
Ah, you should have told me. I would have queued up.
100%.
100%. I should have queued up the
So, isn't that so cool?
graduation song.
So it can be done, folks. It really can be done. I don't think any other student, as far as I know, has achieved that score in a final in CAVI.
100% on a final. Couldn't believe it. Congratulations, John.
There's two of us, at least. Thank you. I'll
The
see you guys
practice.
next week.
Well, congratulations, John. Sure. The practice final I put back this morning when I was doing Kylie's exams for her is there and can be taken for the next 7 days if anyone wants to have a go at the practice final. You're not going to be marked on it. So if you bomb it, don't stress. But if you
Exactly. It's a
use it as a
learning tool. That's
tool,
what it's for.
it's a learning tool. So you can say, oh, I might have to sort of polish up on certain aspects of my, you know, my knowledge before I take the plunge and do what John did.
Okay, well, if that's it, I might see you all next week.
Yep, see you for
Gotcha.
advanced laptops.